I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. We're trying to see ourselves as others see us in this one. How does a European socialist politician see the collapse of American free market capitalism half a year into the Obama term? The money, the politics, the culture of the crisis. The answer is, with a lot more respect than you or we would have expected. Alfred Gusenbauer is a burly, fun-loving, 49-year-old professional Paul on the left side of Austria and European affairs. He's been a leader in the Socialist International. Last year and the year before, he was Austria's chancellor at the head of a center-left coalition. He's a fellow at the Watson Institute this year. Happy to begin by saying that public morale, political direction setting, popular trust all feel better here than over there.
Just to tell you a joke, I was sitting together with Angela Merkel, and she is coming from Eastern Germany, as you know. And she asked me, do you know what is the difference between capitalism and communism? And I said, well, of course I could explain. She said, no, it's a joke. I said, okay, what's the joke? And she said, you know, in communism, first they are going to nationalize everything and then destroy it. And in capitalism, it's the other way around.
Speaking of the other way around, we were joking about the Berlin and the Viennese view of absolutely everything. In Berlin, the situation is serious but not desperate. In Vienna, every situation is desperate but not serious. On those terms, how would you describe the economic crisis?
Well, it's terrible for those that are affected. And I see two vulnerable groups. Those that are older than 50, where the priority of spending for requalification schemes will not go, because all the governments will prioritize younger workers or the younger labor force for requalification programs. So the elderly will be, to a certain extent, left out. This is one huge problem group. And the second one is the youngsters. Because with this enormous increase of unemployment that we are facing right now, all those that are leaving nowadays universities, grammar schools, technical education schemes whatsoever, they try to enter the labor market and find closed doors. And we cannot predict what this might mean for their social and political behavior. I mean, only in Austria you get each year 80,000 youngsters that are going to the labor market. And if they find closed doors, what does it mean if the next 2 or 3 years this happens like that? And I just want to recall what we experienced in Greece last year with the protests of the students because of their lousy studying qualities at the universities. I mean, this went quite far in terms of public violence and in terms of challenging the state authority. So I think nobody can predict right now which social and political effects a longer duration of the crisis might have upon different groups. And this will be the real challenge for European democracy and for the European welfare state, to hold the social fabric together in times when it is fundamentally challenged.
Alfred Gusenbauer, I'm looking for alternative ways to see this global economic crisis. We're getting used to it, but I don't think we begin to understand it yet. In conversation with you, I'm especially eager to hear a European view and a socialist take on what's happened and where we're going.
Well, what happened is quite simple. We faced one of the biggest bubbles ever in the history of capitalism, it's not the first bubble that we are observing. And maybe some of the policy instruments in the U.S. Led to a continuation and to an increase of the bubble for a longer time, which made it worse. But the main thing behind it is that we have enormous economic imbalances in the world, enormous savings that are searching for returns. And on the other hand, we had created some sort of artificial demand in the U.S. for several years that were all leading up to this enormous bubble that burst right now. And the result we all see, enormous consequences in the real economy. And my perception is that we are not able to continue as we did before. So the suggestion of the conservatives, let's go through the crisis, and when we are through, we continue where we stopped before the crisis, this will be the exit to the next failure. And therefore, I pledge for some more fundamental changes in the world economy in order to make economic development much more sustainable. And I think the main difference with before has to be that even if conservatives and others do not like to hear that, a world of today needs more social justice and more equitable income distribution to develop more sustainable. Mm. With the differences we have, there is no chance.
Go back one sec. You make it sound a little too simple. Do you think we've seen...
What do you mean, too simple? I put it in a way that you could understand it.
Well, I'm simple enough, but have we seen the real consequences of this bubble bursting yet? I keep suspecting that we've been anesthetized by this propping up of the stock market and the reliquidizing of the banks, but that these short-term remedies are going to run out.
Well, but the thing is that in real terms, what we observe in the U.S. is that for several months we were losing 600,000 jobs per month. Now it's down to 300,000 jobs per month. The prediction for the European Union is for 2009-2010 that in total we are going to lose between 8.5 million to 9 million jobs, which is the worst job destruction that we have since the 30s of the last century. And it's true that in Europe this is just at the beginning, because up to now we have a gradual increase of unemployment, but it's going worse and worse from month to month. So if you would say that we are just at the beginning of the real consequences for real people, you are right. But there is already a certain estimation to where it might lead, only in job and economic terms. Nobody can predict nowadays to where it would lead politically and socially.
That's what I want to talk about. We keep talking about numbers. We don't talk about a cultural change or change of understanding of what sort of a human situation we're in. Where does that take you?
In my understanding, what we face right now is that most of those people that are losing their job right now will never get a job again. Because they're
qualified. Never get a job.
Never get a job again. Because only a certain percentage of those that are losing their job right now will be engaged in retraining programs and other schemes that might offer them a possibility to enter the job market again when there are new jobs. But most of the old jobs and the old qualifications are gone. And therefore the huge danger is that people over 50 that are losing their job right now most probably might not be able to enter the job market again. Which would, by the way, even aggravate the demographic challenge that we anyhow have, in at least in Europe nowadays. The second thing is that there is a certain paradigm of progress in Europe, which said that we have eternal growth. And since 1945, things were going better and better, and one year after the other created more wealth, and kids would be better off than their parents, parents would be better off than their grandparents. And it seems that this development or this pattern of development is breaking right now. Because even in times of boom, growth rates in Europe were quite modest. Growth was mostly coming from Central and Eastern Europe. And now we are in this crisis. Growth might come back in 2011 or 2012, which will not immediately lead to a recovery in the job market. So the general perception that things are permanently going to be better, I think that this paradigm of progress is breaking nowadays in Europe and creating enormous, enormous political consequences, which are expressed by, let's say, the decrease in participation in elections, the increase of political support for populist and nationalist parties. So the entire political and social fabric that held the European societies together over decades is very much challenged nowadays.
We'll go back to Europe, but I want you to tell us about a European view in the States. You do an awful lot of traveling. You bring a very sophisticated European mind. What are you seeing in America in the way we talk about it, in the actual consequences, in our understanding of this situation, and in Obama and the Congress trying to grapple with it?
Well, I have to say that the U.S. is dealing much better with the crisis than Europe at the moment. Yes, I think so. And especially you have a government and a president that is taking the country ahead. I mean, the stimulus package, the budget, this tells you a clear lesson. To invest nowadays in infrastructure, in health, in education, in green technology, this is the best answer a government could give nowadays, especially with all the deficiencies in those sectors you have accumulated in the United States over the years of Republican rule. And therefore, I think that what the U.S. government is doing right now, compared with all the others in Europe, is the best one could do. And in my understanding, this also affects people positively. We just talked about it when walking here, you know. In the U.S., people have a certain optimism that sooner or later you are coming out of the crisis. And even if you are on a monthly basis losing jobs continuously, people already have the hope in the recovery. And this is very distinct from the European point of view, you know. We are already fearing the decline before it happens. And when the decline is there, many people will sustain all their fears of the decline before, let's say, a recovery really happens. So in Europe, we need at least half a year or a year of recovery till people will turn their mind. In the U.S., there is already a certain optimism, despite the fact that the situation still does not improve.
I wonder if we get it. Maybe we don't understand the bad news yet.
I think, well, I think it's not a question of naivety. It's a question of approach. And the truth is that you have a government in which the people trust. And this is
very true.
And that's very, very important. And of course, if the first positive news are that the job losses are continuing but diminishing, and that we do not have 600,000 jobs less, but 300,000 jobs less per month, by people is already understood as a good message. And everybody understands that all the measures that are taken by government cannot change the situation from one day to the other. That requires a certain time to implement them. But the fundamental difference is that nowadays people in Europe don't trust their governments, and that in the United States, people have full trust in the president and its government.
I wonder, is the new Europe, the integrated economy, the Eurozone and all that, even capable of dealing emotionally, politically, socially with these hard times? I mean, what we read about is the Polish immigrants in Ireland and elsewhere in Eastern Europe going home, and national governments taking protective, very local measures for their own folk. This was not the idea of a free immigration zone and a one Europe. What's the danger here? Or what's the news?
I think that it's not a bad news that the Polish people are leaving Ireland and going home. Because I think that the economic recovery in Central and Eastern Europe will start sooner and be stronger than in Western Europe. And for this purpose, all those countries terribly need their people. And anyhow, I think it's a waste of talent and a waste of excellence if Polish university graduates are working as taxi drivers in Dublin when you so terribly need the talent at home.
And they need those plumbers back in Warsaw.
Yes, yeah. I think you need those plumbers back in Warsaw. And I think that's not the bad news that many of those are going back into their countries where they are terribly needed right now. The bad news is the attitude, the protectionist attitude behind it. So to say, we want to save our country and we do not care about the foreigners that have so much contributed to the wealth, for instance, in Ireland. This is a terrible attitude, which in the long run can create political difficulties within Europe. But the economic fact that people are going back now to Romania, Poland, Bulgaria, this is a good element because we were, for instance, as Austrians, we can observe it very clearly. I mean, we were already observing a lack of manpower in some qualifications in Western Hungary. We didn't find the people there in Western Hungary to work in all the businesses that were established there. I mean, they already had to recruit Austrians to go to Western Hungary because there was such a demand for labor. And therefore, I think it's not a bad idea that some of the most qualified are going back.
At the big picture level, I'm still confused as to what we're learning about Europe. There was a sort of expectation that when the comeuppance came after Iraq, that Europe, the euro specifically, would come into its own. Overall, who's gaining or losing in this sort of underground competition between the European model and the American?
First of all, the euro was an incredibly stabilizing factor within that crisis. I do not want to imagine the happening of that crisis with all the different currencies still there in Europe. This would have led to turbulences in the international markets that would have been incredible. And when we just look back to the beginning of the 90s, when we had the crisis of the pound and the Swedish krona, which were only two, and you would imagine what happened to them now should happen to all the currencies that are now part of the euro. So this would have made the disaster even worse. The third question is, who would come out of this crisis better, the American or the European model? First of all, we observe a certain switch of the American towards the European model. Second, the European model fundamentally is okay, but it needs a lot of renovation because the old feature of the welfare state has come into ages. And a welfare state that is so much dedicated to pensions, that is so much dedicated to the redistribution among the middle classes of the society, and which is not able to address the ardent issue of the increasing number of poor, which is not able to address the question of the generational distribution of wealth. Such a welfare state, by all means, is under enormous, enormous pressure. And therefore, I think that Europe nowadays is on the crossroads, and it's on a double crossroad. The one is, are we able to renovate our welfare state in order to make it feasible also for the new challenges that would have been there with or without crisis? And the second crossroad is, are we following the European model, or are we breaking apart and going back to the nationalist history?
Mm.
And tendencies are there. When you follow the improvement of some of the very right-wing nationalist parties in the European elections, there is an increasing number of the population in almost all the member states who are advocating a more nationalist, less European attitude. And in my understanding, we are coming to a very, very crucial moment where either Europe is able to move forward with enlargement, with the political integration, with the implementation of the Lisbon Treaty and making Europe more political, or those tendencies on the nationalist side are getting either stronger or will be appeased by the mainstream parties and by that dissolve the idea of the European project.
So that's the European versus nationalist dimension. What about the capitalist socialist dimension, the left-right broadly, but specifically the responsibility for the economy, managing it, and the larger social interest?
Well, what we observe is that nowadays all the center-right parties in Europe are moving to the left. They are trying to embrace the social democrat agenda, and they are quite successful in doing so, at least what concerns the electoral outcome.
What's the example there?
If you look to the German Christian Democrats, for instance, I mean, Angela Merkel today and Angela Merkel in the electoral campaign 4 years ago.
Yes.
I mean, that's all the way from neoliberalism to social democracy. No? Mm. So I think they have understood that with an ardent neoliberal program, you're not able to win any electoral support nowadays. And with the move of the center-right going to the left, of course, it makes it more difficult for social democrats to prevail in elections like the ones we had last Sunday on the European level. But the tendency in Europe is clear. Europe nowadays is moving in the direction of more state, more social balance, more involvement of trade unions and the labor movement, and is moving away from the neoliberal paradigm that was prevailing for the last 20 years.
Hmm. Come back to the big imbalances. I want you to spell them out very literally. When I think of the imbalances that this whole crisis reveals, I think, first of all, of just the difference between Americans as consumers and the Chinese as makers. But there's also this huge imbalance of haves and have-nots and poor, starving people who are still starving, maybe even more so. What are the imbalances you're talking about? And then how do you imagine bridging those differences?
I'm talking about both types of imbalances. The one is the present imbalance between those that have a current account deficit and those that have a current account surplus. Mm. So, as you mentioned, the Americans are the huge consumers and the Chinese are the huge producers. But the Chinese are not the only ones. Mm. The export champions of the world are still the Germans with a current account surplus of 10% of their GDP.
Amazing.
And it's not only the Germans, it's also the Austrians and several others. And in the category of the consumers might be the United States, and in Europe, for instance, Greece or Spain, you know, countries with a rather low productivity growth of their economy, high consumption, high current account deficit. And this is a picture that is present all around the world. And as long as we are not going to export our goods to the moon, wherever there is surplus, on the other hand, there has to be deficit. That's quite obvious. The second dimension of the imbalances is, of course, the imbalance between the poor and the rich, be it within the countries or on the global level. And again, the same parameter applies. I mean, if you're terribly rich, and you're for sure, what are you doing with all your money? If your yacht is already 350 feet long, what is the next dimension? The yacht of 500 feet, 1,000 feet, I do not know what. Where are you going to spend all your bloody money? You will not be able to spend it. So you will put it into the financial markets as some sort of capital and saving that only works if others are needing the money. But what we are talking about is a very artificial type of demand, where on the other hand, you have millions and millions and millions of people with unsatisfied needs for food and clothes and living and houses and whatsoever. So that a more sustained demand structure, which would create a more sustained economic development, can only happen if there is more equitable income distribution. Because it's very clear, also in Europe, to spend now €1 in the saturated economies of Germany or France or Austria or whatsoever is creating a much lesser effect than spending €1 in Hungary or Romania or Bulgaria or whatsoever.
Mm.
And therefore, within Europe, I think it's very clear. Our hope is in the East. Because from there, the demand will come. From there, the energy will come. And from there, let the dynamics for the future economic development will come. And we are free to decide. Are we going to support such a development with a clear redistribution of resources that we have in Europe going to the East? Or if we don't support such a development? And I would say each euro nowadays spent in Romania or Bulgaria of European money is a better spent euro than in Sweden, Denmark, or in the saturated economies of the West.
You're a practical, experienced politician. Could you sell that idea of investing in have-not Europe in an Austrian forum?
I think that one
in
can
these
sell.
Times, I mean,
I think that one can sell that and say, listen, what is our problem? Our problem is that we are losing our markets. If we are not selling cars, you are going to lose your job. So we have to sell our cars. We need people that are ready to buy our cars. Where are the best, most regulated, based on rule of law markets in our vicinity? It's the new member states of the European Union. And therefore, I tell you, it's much better to spend €1 in Romania than to spend €1 in Austria. Because the euro spent in Austria will directly go into the saving rate and not in an increase of the sales of cars.
When I first met you around the time of the Obama inauguration, I thought your push and the push of events would be to lower consumption in the United States, to pull back, to acknowledge a kind of depression, rather than to pump up demand. We seem to be back in the keep it going mode.
No.
No?
We are not. What is increased nowadays is not the private demand, which means the private consumption, but what is increased in the U.S. is the public demand. So if the government is putting money into infrastructure or health or education or green technologies, this is mainly public demand. This doesn't mean increased consumer spending. And this is why I think that Europeans should not wait till they recover in the U.S., because the traditional pattern was that when the U.S. economy is going to pick up, well, sooner or later the wave will come into Europe and we are saved too. I think this time it will be different, because the measures that are taken by the U.S. government are not stimulating the private demand. They are a stimulus for the public demand. And as this is not a stimulus for private demand, it will not necessarily increase immediately the private consumption. It will not necessarily increase the American demand for products from Europe. And if it would increase the demand for additional goods, then still there will be the competition between the Chinese and the Europeans who is going to be the supplier. And therefore, the old myth that if the U.S. is picking up, sooner or later, Europe will come back too, will not function this time anymore.
I'm fascinated with what a socialist mind like yours observes about the responses these days in famously anti-socialist America. We certainly talk the anti-socialist game. How different are the responses here, actually?
Well, I think the problem of the U.S. is this so-called anti-socialist paranoia. So as long as you do not call it socialist, you can do whatever you want. This reminds me of the old Austrian thing, you know. As long as you call our security concept neutrality, you can do what you want. You know? but as soon as you question neutrality, you will come into deep difficulties. And as soon as if you would here in the U.S. call a certain policy a socialist policy, then you would enter difficulties. But in substance, what is nowadays done in the U.S. is good European social democrat anti-crisis policy.
Alfred Gusenbauer, you're hanging out in the United States nowadays in a very, very peculiar time in my experience. How do you find us, if I may be so bold? I'm always interested in how others see us. How are we doing?
Well, I think you're quite nice guys.
We're great guys. But then what?
I think that what I can observe is that the Americans are dealing quite well with the crisis. I mean, they have to hope that things are going better. They try to make their way through with all the private initiatives they can undertake in order to help and to survive. And I do, at least here on the East Coast, I do not feel that psychological depression, but quite the contrary, that people give the impression we are able to go through that.
How do you see us moving toward a cultural change here, around a redefinition of our economic system?
I cannot envisage that cultural change already in the U.S. The cultural change in the U.S. Is going much more slowly, because I think that most of the people still have the impression we can get out of this crisis on our own.
You mean family by family, region by region?
Yes.
Us as a country?
Yes.
What would you tell them?
To a certain extent, they are right. They are not right in general, but they might be right for the United States. Because there is still an enormous potential in the country. There is an enormous potential to create some sort of domestic demand. It's still the biggest economy in the world, which has other possibilities than others. And what one should not underestimate it's a consumer and not an exporter country. And therefore, it's finding itself on a different side than, for instance, Europe.
I have to ask you about President Obama. What does an Austrian politician see in this man? His ratings are so favorable that people now have to explain, no, he's not God. But he's been remarkable. What do you see?
Well, we just talked about it when walking here. One should not underestimate that maybe among the politicians that are available on the world at the moment, he is the best educated one. He is a Harvard Law School scholar. He has the highest academic qualifications. In addition, he has worked hard in his job, in his career as a politician. And he is bringing more personal expertise, more personal added value into the job than most of all the other politicians around the world. And he's coming at the time which is tremendously bad for many, and where the desire for change is so omnipresent also in the United States. And he, with his charisma and with his intellectual outfit, is able to address this desire for change. And, I mean, if you listened to his speech in the University of Cairo, for instance, addressing the Muslim world, from whom else on the globe would you expect such a speech?
That part gets a little scary. It's hard to imagine anybody else playing his role.
It's better to have one to play that role than none.
Alfred Gusenbauer, it's a pleasure. And we're going to have this conversation again and again and again.
Thank you very much.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation with Austria's once and maybe future Chancellor, Alfred Gusenbauer. Our interns, Hannah Olson and Chantal Berman, helped us in and out of the session. Post your own measure of East and West and how we're doing at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.